All right, folks, Adidas. Adidas is pushing the boundaries once again in golf footwear. And if you've been counting, I haven't been counting. It's a lot of times. But they're doing it again, so whatever many times it's been, it's at one. So you need to check this out. It's called the Code Chaos, all capitals. The footwear team let me know that this shoe is meant to break down traditional stereotypes and make a statement that there doesn't have to be one look for the sport when it comes to golf footwear. It's athletic and bold from a style standpoint, but this shoe is seriously packed with technology. It's spikeless, but beyond just being tested with guys like DJ and Xander, they did heat map studies. Heat map. That means they know where you are right now. They literally know. And watch, I'm telling you, you're going to get an ad for Adidas footwear in your feed. I'm telling you, and it's not me. I don't know if it's them. It's probably Xander, not DJ. Xander's got an X in his name, so he's a little more sinister. Even though I would probably feel more likely that DJ would really, he could do some damage with the club to my face. So to see how players shift their weight, they use this heat mapping technology to see where they shift their weight, but also where you are physically at this current moment throughout the swing. So anyway, with all that info, they created a new traction system called Twist Grip. Twist Grip. That's spelled the way it sounds. Anyway, so the players get the grip they need exactly where they need it, and this is an ad lib, and when they need it. I just added that. It's waterproof. Waterproof is key. Let's get honest, folks. If you want a waterproof shoe, unless you live in the desert, you can wear sandals or moccasins. But for everybody else, you need the waterproof shoe. So hit up the Code Chaos. It's waterproof, lightweight, and obviously has the boost cushioning, which we all love. There's even a high-top BOA version, which I'm not sure I'm man enough to rock, but John Rahm is. But he's very, very good at golf. We can all agree. These things are next level, so get yourself a pair. Head over to adidas.com/codechaos. Spelled the way it sounds. Although the C-H in chaos sounds more like a K. So it's CODECHAOS. And shop the styles and follow Adidas Golf on Instagram and Twitter for all the latest news from Les Trois Stripes. That's three stripes, folks. All right, one more ad read. I'll probably do another one after this. Jones Sports Co., folks. If you want the bag that I rock, it's the Jones Sports bag. They got the Player Series. They got the original. What are the other? What's the other models they got? The stand bags? We're pulling it up in the studio, folks. But here's the thing. Jones, if you haven't seen the video on YouTube yet, please check it out. We went up there, visited with them. We designed a lot of cool stuff. We're going to be designing more stuff. We have two bags on the Random Golf Club site that have the Random Golf Club script on it. The Utility Trooper is the info I'm getting of the name of the other bag that I like. It's got the stand bag. I mostly rock the original, which is based on a design from the 70s. Was his name Jones? His name was Mr. Jones? Mr. Jones and me. Now, that guy got in a lot of trouble for some, what's that? Taxi cabs. But the guy who sang the song, Mr. Jones, he's gotten a lot of trouble. Don't want to talk about him. But Mr. Jones, not that the song is written about, was a taxi driver in New York. He made a golf bag out of the upholstery in his taxi. And that's where Jones has come from. So they're obviously the comfortable shoulder strap on the original series is what I love. Got a lot of cargo space, and you got three pockets to hold all your clubs. And you look basically like a badass. If you don't have a significant other at the start of the round, you will have one at the end. Am I right? Watch out. It's you know, that's the studio here says, get a Jones bag. I'm not going to say get laid, but basically that's what's going to happen. I mean, I didn't say it. You said it. You heard it. I didn't say it. Jones Sports Co., everybody. Love them. TaylorMade, folks. I got to tell you, the first golf clubs that ever went in my little old hands were TaylorMade Burner Oversize. They had some crusty old grips that I redid myself at risk of my own fingertips with the razor, and I got high because I don't know if you've ever re-gripped your clubs, but you become an inhalant addict because you're putting like really noxious stuff. Don't grip your own clubs unless you really want to. Anyway, mad respect. Give me a fist bump whenever I see you. I grip my own clubs. I put the grips on them myself. I saved. How much did you save? I mean, you could save money. You save money because I think you put them on, it's like $20 each. And you buy the grips yourself, it's like $8. By the way, regripping 14 clubs, I mean, that's like a lot. Go buy TaylorMade's instead. They come with grips. My favorite TaylorMade edition now, obviously the Sim Max I'm playing, is a monster club. One of the many things Tiger Woods have and I in common is playing the sim, but also I kind of love the wedges. The raw-faced wedges, MG. I both love the high toe in matte black. I also have a matte black shaft. I know you didn't ask, but I went ahead and told you. Anyway, TaylorMade, my favorite thing about TaylorMade beyond the incredibly performing equipment is the people that make this company up. The band of brothers down here, the band of sisters, the family in Carlsbad really, really gets behind what we do, and that means it's important for you to get behind what they do. So go support TaylorMade, everybody, and hit them straight, or just don't. Just hit them with TaylorMade's, though. Just stop messing around with all the others. Hit them straight with TaylorMade, but just hit TaylorMade at least. I mean, if you're not, I mean, just go. I mean, what are you doing? Just pause the pod. Go on TaylorMade. What's their website? They don't even need a website. Just go find TaylorMade ASAP. There should be, what? What I play? I play the, okay, studio is asking me to play. I play the P760s, 4 through pitch. Then I've got the milled grind raw face 50, 54, and 58. And then I rock. I'm in between the gapper and the sim hybrid right now. I play the 2 gapper. I've got a steel shafted 6.5 Project X in that one, as with all the irons. And then on the driver, I have the Sim Max with a 9 degree. I'm still working on getting my numbers on that. I don't really know. I got the 10.5 and the 9. We're going to do a little experimentation. Maybe, honestly, you know what? Whatever one I don't use, how about it's yours? How about that? I don't know how we're going to manage this. Head over to the Instagram account. Get ready for the old giveaway of the driver that I can't hit. Anyway, TaylorMade's the family, folks. Welcome to the Eric Anders Lang Show, everybody. Today, very special guest, my friend and my colleague, Paul Sutcliffe. Paul, you are many things. You are, one of them is you're about 5,500 miles away in the jewel of a town known as St. Andrews. You have every golfer's dream job, which is you work for the RNA, and you have a long history of working in sports media. I assume you probably have two answers when someone asks you what they do. When a golfer asks you what they do, you probably play down the fact that you work for the RNA. Or what's your answer for that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I always just say I run the content for the Open, which is essentially what I do. But there's obviously a little more to it than that. But yeah, I'm in charge of a small team that runs the output for the professional championships for the RNA. So that's all the Open social media, website, all the video content that we produce. And then from this year, we've also taken on the AIG Women's British Open into our portfolio, which is really exciting. And looking forward to getting the team sort of stuck into creating content for those channels as well. So in a nutshell, that's it. Yeah, it is a little bit of a dream job, to be honest. Yeah, I moved from Manchester, as the accent probably gives me away that I'm not Scottish. But yeah, I moved up from Manchester 2.5 years ago to take a job at the RNA. And it's been fantastic, yeah. And here we are.
And when you, and folks, I just want to paint a couple different photos of Paul here. So the one that I'm seeing right now is Royal Portrush, the media tent. It's a massive tent. And essentially, you know, there's hundreds of media members from all over the world. Every continent, maybe with the exception of Antarctica, is there to cover this, you know, incredible, incredible sporting event. The first major, which, you know, we're going to get into a project that we collaborated on. A video that is available. If it's not available right now, it's available in like one day. I don't know when the podcast and the delivery date is, but it's basically go there now. And but there's this room in the back where if you ever look at anything from the Open social handles on the website, that's all basically coming from Paul and his team of also guys who have dream jobs and girls who have dream jobs. And really, it was kind of a teaching experience for me to see how you guys do it all. And you know, we made some videos at Portrush. You know, we did a little. I made some videos on my phone, and then I would bring them into the tent and I would say, okay, you know, by the way, tent is misleading. This is a military shed. That's like,
it's a village. It's a village.
It's a village. Yeah. And, you know, it's just a ton of desks and, you know, it's probably a team of 20, 25 all making content.
Yeah, we have 20, yeah, about 25 in that room, but then that doesn't incorporate video and TV. So there's probably another 15 who are in a porter cabin out back who are doing video and TV stuff on site.
At one point, Paul described his year to me as it has two parts. One part is sort of looking back on what just happened, for example, in Shane Lowry's case at Port Rush. And then it immediately switches into getting ready for what's next. And that's got to be a very, you know, working in golf, actually, a lot of people, I know in the media space, there's an element of redundancy in normal sort of PGA Tour scheduling, because it's like, okay, Kapalua, next is, I don't know my PGA Tour schedule clearly, but you know, next is Farmers, next is Waste Management, next is Genesis, next is Pebble. I got those out of order, but your world is wonderfully diverse with the selection of courses that are played. You've got a history that no other tournament has. You've got winners, you've got the youngest winners, you've got a family of winners, you've got, you know, people traveling from all over the world to compete and spectate. The stories that you're able to pull out of this event, I would imagine it's probably like, you know, painting with gold paint. I mean, it is hard, obviously, and you have deadlines and you have metrics and numbers and things you need to do. But on some level, it's like, it's not within the dream job category. It's also like, you've got the easiest story to tell, the story of the oldest major, the story of, you know, Scottish beginnings.
Yeah. Well, we like to say we have the greatest stories in golf. And I think, you know, I'm incredibly privileged to work for a brand like the Open, and I call it a brand loosely, but it's been running. And well, you know, we'll move on to talking about the film, but some of the things we reflect in the film is really, it almost brings it home to you how long this championship's running. I think one of the lines is 75 years after the Open had been running, the TV was invented. Like these sorts of things that you don't really comprehend when you've been working there for 2.5 years. But yeah, we've got an incredible history, an incredible amount of stories. And I think we're really just scratching the surface on the stories we've told in depth so far. You know, there's obviously we've got an incredible archive, as you and the team know, Eric, because you guys obviously were doing a deep dive into it as part of the project. But we're incredibly lucky. On your point about the once a year tournament, is an odd mindset. It's like there's not that many sporting events that have the same setup that we do, where we're an event that moves every year, but we're a once a year event, and that has challenges, obviously, with you know, for the guys who stage the Open, there's immense challenges with that, and they do an incredible job every year of you know, building a small town in little seaside towns in the UK. But from a content point of view, it actually is a great thing that we move around, because every year we have new stories to tell, new people to meet at the courses, people who make the Open happen. And obviously then the championship itself every year seems to throw up incredible drama and great stories. So yeah, it's a fantastic event to work on. And like I say, I've only done two Opens myself. Sadly, we won't get to do one this year, but even the two that I've done, we did. Carnoustie was just phenomenal, with Tiger being back in the mix, the first, you know, well, one of the first times he was back in the mix. And then obviously last year with Shane Lowry at Port Rush, some scenes that I've not seen before in golf, really, certainly not in my time watching golf. So yeah, it's been incredible.
I want to take 1 minute and do a PSA. You're drinking out of a Master's cup. You're
not meant to mention that. We were specifically told this wasn't going to be on video. That's why I've got the Master's cup. No, it's fine. I love the Masters too.
You love the Masters, but you're part of a community of governing bodies of golf, the USGA, the RNA, the PGA, European Tour, PGA Tour. So, you know, those of you listening, to give you a quick breakdown of kind of how things work, you know, not every tournament is PGA Tour. And so what I'm really getting at, though, is, and you've even got WGC, but they're not really part of the rule-making body of golf. What I'm about to point out is that we're talking about the Open. We're not talking about the British Open. And I just feel like I need to do my service as a world citizen, much less an American, that there is no such thing as the British Open. True or false, Paul?
That is true, Eric, and thank you for that. It's not something we like to ram down people's throats, and I guess we get why some of the American audience and media might call it the British Open. And I think at a time in our past, we may have also referred to ourselves as the British Open. But I think we can legitimately stand up now that we are the Open and you know, we are golf's original major. And I sound like I'm reading from a brand playbook here. But
well, you wrote it.
I didn't write it. But yeah, you know, it is the Open. I mean, and certainly from my perspective, growing up in the UK, the Open is what got me into golf. It's what I assume most of the British public is their entry route into golf, if it's not through family and playing. And you know, it's like I say, it's just a special brand. And while I know that some of the US audience might call the US Open the Open, that, you know, they might refer to that as the Open, and that's fine. But we over here will always refer to it as the Open. Yeah.
So there are a couple things in golf that make my hair on the back of my neck stand up. One of them is the term golfing. I'm not a fan, but that's not really, we can talk about that another time. The other is the British Open, because it just denotes that you're not a world golf citizen. The Open was first. It was called the Open originally. It's called the Open now. If you want to talk about the event that the USGA runs, that's called the US Open. And I think that we're all agreed on that as far as governing bodies, as far as anyone who, you know, works for Augusta National and promotes and creates content around the Masters is not going to call it. Am I right, Paul? They're not going to say, you're going to go to the British, you're going to go to the British Open, they're going to say the Open. I mean, everyone at the top level, I'm just trying to inform the people listening who don't already have a job at a governing body in golf or a media. I mean, even the media, they're all agreed. This isn't, I'm not trying to say this is the fifth major and it's the Players. I'm saying this is what it is, and just want to make sure that the people out there have that. If nothing else, they can at least call it the Open at Royal St. George's in 2021.
Absolutely. Well, look, we'd be delighted if everybody referred to us as the Open.
Good.
And that's as much as I'm going to say on it.
So we're going to get into this podcast is sort of aimed at, this was something that I wanted to do to talk about this incredible opportunity that you bestowed on me, Paul, which was to make a film. And it's something that the most I'm proud of so far to date in the merging of golf and filmmaking. But before we get into the film, I'd like to talk a little bit about the origin of kind of how we met. I know that we've talked a little bit about it. We were over there, it was about a year and a half ago now, for the unofficial Scotland vlogs. And Jamie Darling had us set up playing 26 courses in 16 days. If you haven't seen it, it's on our YouTube channel. We've got the pinnacle of that series is Stuart playing the Old Course with his father. Paul, we were early on in the trip, relatively, maybe just before halfway through, and we had posted our schedule, and I had said to Jamie and the powers that be with Scottish tourism and Scottish golf that we wanted to invite as many people to play with us as possible locally. And all I remember is there was messages coming in and people saying, I live near Troon, you know, do you still have room? And then I would say, yes, come join us. We're playing at 9 a.m. And then we would end up with some friends. With Western Gales, we somehow illegally played with a fivesome. I don't know how they let that slide. Fivesomes are not popular in Scotland. Everything else is okay. Dogs, Paul's dog, Buddy. I've played multiple rounds with Buddy. What type of ball? Buddy's a lab?
No, he's an English Springer Spaniel.
Ah, Springer, of course. That explains the jumping.
He'd be really upset that you didn't know that, you know.
I'm bad with dog gender and dog breed. I'm good with dogs, though. So we ended up meeting at King's Barnes. And I think, can you tell me a little bit about where you were at that point? I mean, I know I was on the golf course and, you know, Stuart had just joined us, and I know you came and you had sandwiches, and it was just,
well, it wasn't me, let's be clear. I didn't bring you a sandwich. My girlfriend brought out sandwiches for the group, and somehow I ended up without one. I think how I remember the story was that I was obviously following your travels around Scotland with interest for several reasons. Obviously, I'd been watching your content for a while, and obviously I think Adventures in Golf was my route into watching your content, and really enjoyed what you were doing. And I was not long in the job here, and I was thinking about content opportunities for us and how we could do some things that were a little bit different, and really enjoyed the way you were creating golf content because it was so different to what anyone else was doing at the time. So I sent you, when you were coming around Scotland, I sent you a message on Instagram and said, basically, you know, I work at the R&A, I'd like to meet up for a coffee to chat about some ideas, blah, blah, blah. And you just said, oh, come along to, I'm going to be leaving our King's Barnes on this day, come along and we can have a chat. And I don't think you really registered that I'd actually said that I was there in a semi-work capacity, I suppose.
No clue. I remember finding out. I think you told me later again, and I was like, oh, cool. Like, that's, I love the Open. I probably called it the British Open at the time. the hair on your neck probably stood up.
Yeah. So I turned up at King's Barnes anyway to meet you, and I think I walked 9 holes or so. And then at the time I was living in Crail, which is just around the corner, and my girlfriend turned up with the cheesy toast shack toasties for everyone in the group, which I think everyone was grateful for after a very long round of golf, and yeah, I think we just chatted about your content and a few ideas, and really I was just trying to without sounding crass, I was just trying to see if you were really like what you appeared on camera, because you know, like, occasionally you can see people online, or you know, talent in inverted commas, who appear one way and are different in real life. But obviously, you know, we became friends from it, and then started talking about the project that we would go on to work on, and that was really it. And I was also there when the Stuart and his dad moment happened, which was quite a privilege. And it's weird now looking back at that and seeing it and seeing the reactions to it and how everyone's enjoyed it.
Where were you in that moment? Were you standing outside of the R&A clubhouse?
Pretty much, yeah. I was around to the left. So, and you guys were teeing off, and I just went down to watch you guys tee off.
And it was a brief hello as we were on the tee.
Yeah, well, you'd said, we were in the Dunvegan, I don't know if you remember, and you'd said to me, oh, we're going to surprise Stuart with, yeah. Stuart now knows he's playing the old course, but we're going to surprise him, his dad's here. And I was like, oh, that's cool. So yeah, so I just came down and watched it all unfold. It was great. And great, you know, great content. Wow. Proper emotive content.
Yeah, that's...
Which you don't get those moments very organically very often, I suppose.
I've actually, if you're listening to the podcast and you haven't seen that video, I'm assuming you have, but if you haven't seen We Surprised Stuart Twice at the Old Course, please put it on your list. If you like the pod, you'd love that video. It's I've sent that video to some professional golfers and they've all responded just with, like, I've sent it over text. Like, I just text them the video. I say, watch, just airplay it. Just watch the whole thing. Just do me a solid. And they've all responded with just one emoji, which is just a tearing
crying face.
because if anyone loves golf, that's why you got into it. And I'm sure that, you know, that story that we told there with Stuart and his father is echoed with old and young Tom. You know, it goes back. The soil of St. Andrews is made up of those moments, whether they're competitive, personal, whatever it is. The community really surrounds this place. And we don't need to get too far into St. Andrews. I mean, I'm so jealous that you're there right now. Maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like it'd be a great place to just hunker down and just walk.
Yeah, we walk the golf courses. I'm still working from home, but Charlotte walks the golf courses every day with the dog, and then, you know, probably three times a week I get down there. It's about 30 minutes for us to walk to the courses. It's pretty special, and it's a bit of a strange atmosphere because this is the time of year when things would be starting to kick off. You know, the visitors would be starting to arrive, and the place would be starting to get that golf buzz that, you know, unless you've been here, you probably can't appreciate what that's like. But we're very lucky being by the sea and, you know, in green spaces during this difficult time is such a blessing. I can't imagine what it would be like being in a city at this point, or, you know, living in a built-up area. I'm sure it would make it much more difficult. So, you know, we're obviously very lucky to be here. And living in St. Andrews in general is, I park in the little car park next to the 17th green every day and walk. And then I walk down through the snicket next to the jigger in, and then walk up the 17th, past the 17th green and up the road to the office. And most days you're just on your phone, or you've got a podcast in or headphones on or what have you. But some days you'll just get a moment where you'll see someone having a photo on the bridge, or tourists, you know, getting on the 18th tee, just having a moment, and you realize that people are there on a once in a lifetime trip, and that's when it hits home that you're in a really special place. And it's really easy to lose sight of that when you're there every day, but just occasionally you'll get moments that bring it home.
What is a snicket?
Oh, a snicket is a gap between two bushes.
A snicket is a gap between two bushes. Now I know what a snicket is.
All right, I'm going to catch me now. Give me a second, all right? I'm about to do an ad read for Vice Golf. I don't even have a read, so this is an ad lib. This is an ad-libbed read. Anyway, Vice Golf, you all know I love the brand. They make a great golf ball, and there are things that I would tell you in person about the golf ball that I can't tell you in a public forum. But basically, the golf ball is amazing. Technically speaking, on tests, it performs as good or better than what we call, quote, the best golf ball on tour. Now, the Vice Golf ball also has one cool thing, which is that it's cool. Obviously, the scripting is really sweet. But beyond that, as another cool thing, I'm going to keep pulling cool things out of this ball. The second cool thing is that you can't get it in a pro shop. So go online, go to vicegolf.com and get your slick balls. They've got all different types. They've got the tour, they've got the drive, they've got the pro, they've got the pro plus. They've got different colors, and you can also personalize less than, you can personalize, I don't know what number you can personalize, but you can personalize them, whereas other brands don't let you personalize them except for once a year. So check out vicegolf.com, get yourself some smooth and cool balls for the course, that is. Anyway, y'all, see you in the showers until the next ad read. Precision Pro, folks. I'm going to do an ad-libbed Precision Pro read. Here's the thing about Precision Pro. They're made by some great guys in Cincinnati, Ohio. It's got great design, and coming out soon, you're going to get a very special colorway of the NX9 Pro with slope. Is that right? That's it. I got a thumbs up in the studio here that's the exact rangefinder. Not only do you get free battery replacement for life, but you get slope and you get laser. I mean, it is a laser sharp accuracy, and you get, I don't know, you just get to be part of something cool that I'm down with. So Precision Pro is great. Obviously, the family there in Cincinnati makes them good. We did an RGC there. If you haven't seen it, check out the video on the YouTube channel. We gave everybody a rangefinder. But stay tuned. Coming around April, we're going to be releasing a random golf club version of this rangefinder. It is the most beautiful rangefinder I've ever seen on planet Earth. And I, as you know, I haven't traveled any other planets yet. I've done a lot of countries and states and towns. continents, hemispheres, but I've never left the planet. And I was just talking to someone who said that that's on their bucket list. It's not on mine. I don't share that. But on this planet, the Random Golf Club Rangefinder will literally blow your mind, but it won't blow your wallet. The Rangefinder for everyone, people. Enjoy it.
All right. Whoop, folks. Whoop. W-H-O-O-P. I think you know what I'm talking about. You've seen Rory wearing it. You may have seen me wearing it. And I'm pretty much into this wearable device, wearable technology, wearable. I like it. At first, I was like not sure if I was going to like having this thing on my wrist, but I'm into it mostly because of the incredible amount of information that it gives me about me and my life and how to perform better. Like, I'm not going to ever be some amazing athlete, but I do like getting this feedback from my body. So basically, it has inside of it this crazy light that reads not only your heart rate, but all sorts of other things about your body, mostly the time in between heartbeats, the heart rate variability, that's key. Anyway, it provides personalized insights on the performance of your sleep and how recovered your body is and how much stress you put on your body throughout the day from your workouts and the normal stressors of life. Big key takeaway, walking 18 holes, that's a workout, folks. No joke. So anyway, when I get up, I look at my Whoop score. I try to see how I slept last night. And I've tried to incorporate takeaways to get better sleep and, especially when traveling and stuff like that, because rest is really important and, the quality of sleep is really key. So, you know, it has all of these, you know, suggestions for getting better sleep. The biggest takeaway is consume a lot of water. Also I've started exercising more. This thing plugs in great to all of my exercise routines and I can see exactly where I'm at my, max heart rate. It's got a built-in feature with a strain coach that it gives you target exertion goals and workout to work out optimally for the level of intensity. It basically is a personal assistant for your working out. And folks, big deal for you guys. They're offering 15% if you use the code EAL at checkout. That's 15% off whoop.com and enter EAL at checkout to get your discount. Sleep better, recover faster, and train smarter. Optimize your performance with Whoop. It's custom tailors to your body. It takes like a little bit of time to get to know you, and then it knows you. And it's fun because I've got a lot of friends that use it and we talk about it. I'm like, yo, what was your sleep score last night, bro? And basically it's how early did you go to bed and how early did you wake up and did you get distracted while sleeping? It tracks all four stages of your sleep, slow, wave, REM, light, and when you wake up, and it can tell you how much sleep you've actually gotten down to the minute. So it's like the first thing I do when I wake up is I just check it and I'm like, yo, how did we do last night? And I can tell, I can notice the difference now. And it's kind of like that awareness wasn't really there before using the Whoop strap. The Whoop journal allows you to track the decisions that you make during the day and the impact that those have on your recovery. And basically, guys, Whoop can help anyone perform better, whether it's preparing for a golf match, yo, yeah, race, meeting, etc. Whoop can help plan out your day and make smarter lifestyle decisions to help you feel better than ever. And I can say I have definitely improved in a lot of areas there, whether even now when I walk 18, like I feel better, you know what I mean? And I think part of that is you're just focusing on your body's performance. And this is the tool that gives you the insight to do that. So please go check it out. Support the people that support us. Whoop.com, W-H-O-O-P, enter code EAL at checkout to get 15% off.
Let's get into, you know, there's an interesting parallel here between, you know, the project that you proposed and what, and my experience with the subject matter, which is you said, you know, we want to, what do you remember what you said to me? Like what the goal was? I mean, did we accomplish the goal actually? I mean, the film is done. So if we didn't, I don't know what to tell you. It's locked and loaded, but what was the original goal?
I think the brief was, I want to tell the history of the Open in a 15-minute film. I mean, that was roughly the brief. You know, we've got nearly 170 years of history.
That sounds hard, and I'm already done. I want to actually take a moment here. And I have it. Would you be okay, Paul, if I play some audio from the film?
Sure.
So we were tasked with taking a 15, by the way, I have actually just to point out some, you know, facts and figures about the making of this film. It's been a year. We, We worked on this for a year. We shot it about 10 or 11 months ago. And I think the reason why that's important is not because we didn't spend any time working on it, not because it was some 5-hour film, not because it demanded a lot of locations, but because really I admire, Paul, this film is only as good as you forced it to be in some sense. Do you know what I mean? Like you watched, I mean, how many cuts have you watched of this thing?
I think we're on V13 or something like that. And that's probably just the Vs that I've seen.
Yeah, but even within that, you've watched the cuts multiple times. I mean, you have probably spent 10 hours just watching this film over and over. And we've had longer durations. We've had 20, 25 minutes. We've changed things. I mean, and a lot of it is actually archival footage. I think, let's see, we've got a trailer. Should I play the trailer or should I play the open history? What do you think's better?
I think the open history is probably more suitable for audio because it's mostly voiceover, right?
So. Okay. All right. So this is you're going to listen to something here, and it's, again, it's a film. So it's much better when you watch it. Our editor did an incredible job of making this really heat up. So I'm just going to play a little snippet of it so you can get an idea of what we're talking about.
The Open was first played in 1860, 160 years ago. An entertaining event with the best players in the land playing for a small group's enjoyment. What's happened over the last century and a half? Well, the world was a much different place then. Life expectancy was less than half of what it is now. There was no such thing as a car, and people traveled by train or horse to the golf course. The automobile would be invented in 1886, and just 8 years later, John Taylor would win his first Open championship. By 1935, the Open had been going on for 75 years, and though it wasn't popular yet, the television was cutting-edge technology. Just 2 years later, Harry Vardon, who won more Open championships than anyone, passed away in 1937. In 1949, the Open Championship was held at Royal St. George's, and Bobby Locke won his first of four Opens. His prize, £400, which is less than a new driver costs today. When I think back on the event, golf fandom was in its infancy. With television barely covering golf, this was a true in-person spectator sport, with crowds literally huddling around the greens and tee boxes just to get a glimpse of the action. The Open in 1949 had a 36-hole playoff, with Bobby Locke holding on to the victory. Most people had to wait for newspaper articles to come out the next day to relive the moment. What wasn't written about that year was just 3 months later, a young man was born in Kansas City who would go on to become synonymous with the world's oldest golf championship, Tom Watson. Gene Sarazen, at the age of 71, made one of the most famous aces ever during the Open at the infamous postage stamp, forever solidifying his and the hole's legacy with golfers everywhere. And it also proved that at the Open, age is just a number. More than 40 years after lifting the claret jug, Gene Sarazen was still delighting the crowds. And then, in 1975, a legend was born, who would go on to join the ranks of Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus as men who changed the sport and brought it to the masses. So here's where things start moving quickly. Golf balls and clubs begin to rapidly advance, and the game gets bigger in every way. The Tiger era was upon us. Cell phones, email, social media, streaming live broadcasts. The golf world looks nothing like it did back when the red belt was being handed off at Prestwick.
And the title comes up and says, what does that little title say? A Brief History of the Open with Eric Anderson. Dude, Paul, could you hear that?
Yeah.
It gives me chills.
It's very cool in audio, so I just hope people tune in and watch it in video, because it is great. And I know the point you were making before. You know, we've back and forth on this a lot, and obviously we're very busy, you're very busy. It took a long time to get to the place where we want it to be, but I think, you know, I'm really, really pleased with how it's turned out, and I think it was worth all the extra work, you know. Well, so I'll speak for you. It was worth the extra work that was put in by your team, really, to get it to this place. And obviously, it's been a collaboration. I've helped out where I can, I suppose. But you know, the creative direction has come from you and your team. So yeah, it's a great film, and hopefully everyone tunes in to watch it.
Yeah, I think they will. I mean, it really, for me, it was an opportunity to kind of do two dreams. One is, you know, for me, a dream job is to have the RNA say, we'd like you to, you know, focus on what we do, and here's what we're looking. We need to tell this story in it too, because on some level, you know, young fans, they know the Open from the last couple of years, you know, and the truth is there is a tremendous amount of history that, in a sense, you know, has to be told. It's almost like a fish hook. Like the more you know about something, the more interesting it becomes, and the more you care about it. And, you know, so in some ways, you know, obviously, you know, the players, like if you take someone who doesn't know golf and you have them watch a golf tournament, they don't know who anybody is. So the stories don't mean anything to them. But, you know, these stories, as you go back in time, the Open, unlike a lot of tournaments, the story is the history, is the places that have been played. You know, when I played Royal St. George's this year, thinking about Darren Clark in incredible weather and in that incredible story, it came to me. Like, I was thinking about it. You know, you're essentially, you know, hiking through the same puzzle that they hiked through. And in Scotland and in England and Ireland, you have, and the island of Ireland, you have the wonderful experience of walking through these gardens that they've walked through and experiencing. I mean, when I went to Troon, my head almost snapped off, because that could be some of the best golf I've ever seen with Phil and Henrik. And Tom Watson even said the same thing. We did an interview with Tom Watson for this film, and that's coming out in full on our channel. And, you know, it's an excerpt in the film itself, A Brief History of the Open. Tom Watson said that Phil and Henrik's match was better than his and Jack's. And I mean, that just blew me away, because
much humility there is there for a guy who's won five Opens.
Unbelievable. I think, you know, going into the project itself, the film is, it's like a 20-minute film. You know, it was interesting to me, because we really started to uncover something that is probably known very well in within the RNA and within golf historians, especially concerning the origin of the Open. But we uncovered this character that, by and large, 99.9 golfers out of 100 will never have heard his name, and yet, in large part, his life and his death is ultimately responsible for the origin of the Open, for the creation of this tournament that we now watch every year, and people call it the British Open. You know what I mean? Like his little life in Prestwick is responsible for this. What have you learned about this man?
So you're talking about Alan Robertson, right, Eric?
Yeah.
So I don't get this wrong.
It's not a quiz. Yeah.
So Alan Robertson was, I suppose you could say, he was the original champion golfer. Yeah, I mean, his name, you won't find his name on the trophy. Or he's not classed as a winner of the Open, but it was his life and death which really sparked the creation of the Open. Everyone, he was the best golfer around. He was considered the first professional golfer, if you could class someone as a professional golfer in that era. And it was considered that he was the best golfer in the land. And then essentially, his death in 1859 sparked a quest to find the new champion golfer, who is now the best golfer in the land. And that, you know, the line from the film is, and so the Open was born. And that is essentially what it was. 1860, the members and committee of Prestwick Golf Club decided to host a tournament to find out who the new champion golfer was. And that was the first Open.
It would be like, I mean, it's here's, you got to remember, like 1850s, there's no tournament. There's not really even media in the way that we know. It's not really important. And ultimately, it's a very localized experience. I mean, the first Open had, am I going to get this right? Please. The first Open had eight people.
Yeah.
And they played on a 12-hole course, Prestwick, which is now 18 holes. And they played the course three times in one day. They played twice, they had lunch, and they came back and played again. And that was it. So, you know, what we have here is not just a story of professional golf, not just a story of any of one person, not just a story of the winner's share of you know, whether it's a belt, which originally it was a belt that looks a lot like a, you know, a boxing belt, and it's red leather, and that's framed in Prestwick. And, you know, it's not just any of those things. It's the story of kind of how we lived, the story of community, and really the Open, more than any other tournament, is actually just the story of golf. I mean, it really now has become this incredible major, but in the beginning it was just eight people going out and playing a little tournament. I mean, there were people watching for sure, but it's hard to really clarify for anybody listening that, like, it was a community event. And, you know, I think when we go into the global world that we live in now, and our community is made up of every country represented. I mean, to think if Alan Robertson could have said, wow, the first Swedish golfer to win the Open is going to be Henrik Stenson, like, his head would have been completely just frozen. Like, why would there be a Swedish golfer competing in this tournament that we're doing? It's crazy.
It's so long ago that it's really quite hard for me to comprehend what it could have been like. But obviously you've seen the photos, and I think you've seen the minutes as well at Prestwick Golf Club, Eric, that sort of give you a little look back into history. But yeah, I mean, if only we had footage of back in the day just to see what it was like, I suppose. But you could imagine that it was, you know, half a dozen people, 20 people grouped around a green watching these guys put out to call themselves the champion golfer. It is quite mind blowing.
Yeah. We in the film, we got a chance to speak with the secretary at Prestwick to go through the minutes of the Open as they go back in time, and to see the scorecards. Prestwick now, if you visit Prestwick, the layout has changed from when the Open was held there. And, you know, there's just, you can see the little scorecard written in pencil, and it just says Tom Morris. And you can see the scores, and they wouldn't write the scores down with numbers. They would use hashes. So, and there was no par back then either. Par was irrelevant, or they called it bogey. You know, they would basically say, now I'm going to get confused here, but ultimately we need to do a podcast on this at some point. But the suggested score would change based on the weather and the wind and things like that. And they would write their score down just in a little line, and then line, that's a three. Line, that's a four. And they would, and you'll see this in the film, we have images of this going back through history. I think really, you know, we started to talk about Alan Robertson with Ken at Prestwick, the secretary there. And the secretary is, am I right in saying that they are an elected position within the club? Is that right, Paul?
I'm not sure at Prestwick. I think, so the secretary of the RNA is Martin Slumbers, who's also the chief executive of the RNA. So I think it's different at different golf clubs. Right. So I'm not actually sure how Ken came by that position.
Secretary is essentially a member of the club that is in some senses responsible. It's secretary means something different in the UK than it does in the States. I mean, secretary is, it seems like they're very involved in the history. They obviously have a vocal in the running of the club and how it's, you know, managed and things like that. So anyway, Ken and I talked a lot about the origin, and we started to talk about Alan Robertson, and really it actually made a lot of sense to me later on in our experience of filming. So we came to Scotland last year and we filmed for this project for about a week, and it really clicked for me when we went to the RNA Museum, which is just behind the RNA Clubhouse there, and just behind, you know, the 18th green It's this beautiful museum where you can, I mean, it's a absolute must visit. You get, you know, up close look at, you know, the claret jug. You get a lot of videos, photos. It's a really wonderful walk. And I mean, part of me was like, wow, I would like to make an experience like this one day. You know what I mean? Like, it's a visual, it's a space that you can walk through. There's life-sized photos of Poulter and his, you know, outfits through the years. You know, there's like multi-screen video, you know, like pieces. It's really an incredible visit. And lucky enough, we went into this like back room that is, you cannot go to, do not ask, don't say Eric went to this room, can I go? But we got to go to this back room, and Hannah took us, we put gloves on, we went into this room, and it's like the perfect, it's like the perfect temperature for archiving these, you know, papers and clubs. I mean, there was hundreds of golf clubs in there. I saw Alan Robertson's golf ball that he made for himself. You know, back then you had to make your own golf ball. Nope, because golf balls, they didn't come down from a production line. They didn't come from, you know, they didn't come. You had to make it, and you had to make your own clubs. And when you say Alan Robertson was the first professional, what that would mean is he made clubs and he made balls, and then he also played golf. And that was a professional golfer back then. It was merely that they had created a job within golf, and it wasn't their side hobby. So anyway, we go back into this room, this archive, and you know, when we it's so secret that we weren't even allowed to show the routing of how to get to this room. This room is very secret. Do not ever ask me where the room is. But you know, it is filled with incredible icons and, you know, products of the game going all the way back to this era. And in there we see a piece of writing about Alan Robertson and about how his passing basically created a call for the Open, a call to find the champion golfer of the year. And interestingly enough, these gentlemen who were seeking the champion golfer of the year probably had no idea that that would be uttered into microphones around the world to millions on a Sunday in July. You know, they probably didn't know that.
And I think that's the interesting thing about the project, because we were trying to tell this story in a digital format, 15 minutes, but we probably could make another, you know, 20 films easily on these individual stories. You could make a documentary just on Alan Robertson. Eric's pointing,
I'm giving Paul a thumbs up.
But you know, you could. These stories have so much. There's so much to tell there that we probably weren't able to go into in the depth that we'd maybe want to in these films. That, you know, certainly we'll look to tell in the future. And it's just interesting. It's just interesting how how you tackled it in the film, Eric. I think one of the things I kept mentioning in the initial brief and the initial conversations that we had was, we really wanted it to feel like a journey of discovery for you. Like, because from what we'd seen from Adventures in Golf and some of the content you'd put on your own YouTube channel, the best stuff that we'd seen was you making discovery while filming. And you can't really cheat that, right? You can't, you can't cheat. You can't fake that sense of uncovering something. And I think
I can't.
Yeah. And you know, you obviously knew a lot of the Open story, but I genuinely don't think you knew the Alan Robertson, how influential Alan Robertson was to the whole story. And I remember you saying to me, that's, we've got it. That's Alan Robertson's the hook to this thing, when we came out of the museum. And I remember that quite vividly. So it's interesting to see that actually now makes a big part of the film, or, you know, a proportion of the film in the final version.
Yeah. I mean, I'm always fascinated by, etymologies. You know, when I learn where a word comes from, it teaches me so much about what that word actually means and what it has meant through history and how we've changed through history or whatever. The same is true with the history of things, right? Like it's a little bit more complex, but you know, going to the graveyard by the St. Andrew's Cathedral back there, you've got a lot of relevant grave sites. And, you know, obviously you have old and young Tom, but probably just 100 yards away, you've got Allen Robertson's grave. And to think that, wow, this spawned that is really remarkable. And in some ways, it actually makes me zoom out and think about, you know, a problem leading to solution. And, you know, I think a lot of times, depending on my mood, how much sleep I got, or what time zone I'm in, sometimes problem can cause me to kind of recoil. And I'm like, this is a problem. This wasn't the plan. This wasn't the way it's supposed to be. And in some sense, this is an example of a problem where it's like, okay, Allen was unequivocally the best golfer. No one ever beat him. He never lost a money match, like undefeated. And yet his passing created this other question, which was needed to be solved. It created a problem. Oh, geez. I mean, well, now we don't, literally there's guys sitting at the Red Lion right across from Prestwick, and they're saying, so who is the best? I'm the best. You're the best. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to know. I guess we need to create a new tournament that doesn't exist yet, because they've done money matches. They've done caddy games. And at the time, this is when a lot of the matches people would see would be sort of these exhibition matches or caddies playing each other or, you know, whatever it was. This had never been done in any form of golf, any part of the world. I mean, this is before there was a golf course in the United States. This is, and now, you know, based on golf course volume, America has the most golf courses in the world, something like 18,000. This tournament was before there's even a golf course in America. So golf is a very different game at the time. Anyway, all that is to say, sometimes a problem can lead to a better solution and lead to like a new kind of way of looking at whatever it is we do. And so in some ways it can be a good thing. I mean, I'm trying to think of if we had any problems with production or with editing on the film. I mean, I think we shot a lot of things that we didn't end up using. I think that was kind of interesting. Like we found so much incredible archival footage that I just felt less and less like these things that we had shot just didn't, you know, it was really in a sense one of the first projects for me of where it's almost like I'm actually in a sense, I'm almost holding the camera for you. Like it's not so much about me being like, here I am at Royal Troon. This is where Phil and Henrik had their match. You know, it's more like I'm going back to my roots as a documentarian and saying, here's a story. Like when you watch any, I don't know if you're familiar with Alex Gibney, he's one of my favorite documentarians, or Werner Herzog. These cats are never in the film. They're not like on camera saying, hi, welcome to my movie, swipe up, please subscribe. You know what I mean? Like they are telling you the story from behind. It's almost like a puppet master. You don't see their face, but they're doing the voiceover, they're writing the story, they're making sure that the thread of narration is clear. And in some sense, that's really my favorite part about this film, is that it's not really about, it is about me uncovering things like you just said, and you can't fake that. But in some sense, it's almost like more about this story is not about me. And that was kind of an interesting transition, because I think a lot of times I've gotten caught up in, you know, the work that we do is it's like, can Eric break 90? Can we do this? Whatever it is, it was a really wonderful opportunity to really flex that muscle, which is storytelling, but not me telling you a story. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. And I think it's a balancing act, right? You know, the reason we engaged you in this project is A, because you're a good filmmaker and we like the way you did things, but also you do things in a different way than maybe we would do it if we made this film in-house or if we hired a different production agency to create it. So we were always keen that you were, you know, it was your journey, but it was about you taking the viewer along that journey with you. And I think you did a really good job of getting that balance right of, you know, you in situ and on location with getting across everything that we needed to get across in the 15 minutes, because, you know, like we say, almost 170 years of history, 160 years of history, you know, boiled down into 15 minutes is a tough gig.
It was hard.
It's interesting, like, as well, you know, we back and forth a little bit on what should go in the film, what shouldn't go in the film. And, that passing of time, you know, we cover off the first 10, 12 years quite in a little bit of detail. So Alan Robertson, young Tom, old Tom, we cover that off. And then there's like, right, how do we get to 1970 where, not where the next set of stories start, but where actually the footage really, you know, we really have footage from 1970 onwards. And we wanted to bring in obviously the Tom Watson stories. It's how you cover off that amazing amount of history in a short period of time. And, you know, I think when people watch the film, they'll see that we did that in a really clever way. So yeah, absolutely. So it was a difficult job.
So all this is to say, you need to watch the film. You need to watch A Brief History of the Open with Eric Andrews Lang. It is on, if you go to theopen.com and you join the One Club, which is free, and it allows you to access this film and a host of other films. We will be posting a couple snippets of the film, but to see the full finished film, which if you don't see the full finished film, I mean, I would invite you to find another podcast to listen to, just to be totally filled. I would feel really, I'm kidding. You can still listen to the pod, but you should just go do this. And then is there anything else associated with what else is going on? I've never asked you about the One Club, and the One Club is not new. Tell me about that. I don't really know too much about that.
No, the One Club is the Open's membership program. And it offers people primarily priority access to ticketing. So if they want to get tickets before anyone else can, that you can get that through the One Club. But it also offers a lot of exclusive content. So on theopen.com, we've got every official film back to 1970. So nearly 50 official films on there. We've got every episode of The Chronicles of a Champion Golfer, which are amazing documentaries with the greatest players that golf has seen. And if you haven't seen those, you know, absolutely well worth a watch.
So wait, just take a sec there. So these are incredible films. These are what, they're like 20 to 30 minute films about that tournament, and they just dig it. There's nice long form interviews that are produced after the tournament. There's it's just the broadcast. It is a full visceral experience. It's almost better than the tournament itself, if you would.
That's the official films, but and the Chronicles of a Champion Golfer. So the Chronicles of a Champion Golfer are essentially the life story of, I think there's 18 episodes up there now. The life story of 18 champion golfers. So we've got Tiger, we've got Jack, we've got Tom Watson, we've got Patrick Harrington, Darren Clark, Rory McIlroy, Henrik Stenson, all these guys. It's their life story and the story of them winning their Open or their multiple Opens, what drives them. It really is incredible films. And, you know, maybe we don't do a good enough job of promoting that they're there, but I would urge any golf fan to go and watch them, because, you know, some of the stories of how these guys came to be what they are just incredible. And also we see some of the difficult times that some of the champion golfers have faced and how they've overcome those, or how those difficult times have overcome them. And they've, you know, some of them have ended their career in, you know, almost before they would have wanted to. And yeah, there's some great programming on there. So it's all free. The One Club is all a free membership. So literally you just have to go on, give a few details and sign up and you're in. And we're going to be looking to build on the proposition a lot in the coming weeks and months to offer even more content up there. So this is a great starting point as well.
Yeah, I love it. Well, while you guys go on to theopen.com and sign up for the One Club, we're going to end this podcast. Paul and I think, Paul, we should talk about making a film called A Not So Brief History of the Open, and that could take us 2 years.
Well, look, I think there's so much more stories to be told, and however we end up telling those stories, I think this is a great start. And for anyone who's not familiar with the Open's history and the Open story, I think this is a great way into it. And it provides exactly what it says on the tin, a brief history of the Open. There's a lot more to uncover. But I'd just like to, you know, thank you, Eric, and the team for putting in so much hard work on it, because like you say, it has been a long time in the making, and we've probably well overshot the brief that was originally put forward, but I think it's worth it, and I hope that everyone enjoys it when they get around to watching.
Yeah, I know they will enjoy it. I know that they will. Hopefully they'll watch it twice. Because I've watched it hundreds of times. You've watched it hundreds of times. Just watching it twice isn't that much to ask. But Paul, it's really been an honor for me. And I'm just so excited that what we made is something that is real. You know, it's very, very real, and it's cool, and it creates a feeling. And ultimately that's the only reason why I don't make videos so that you can know how long the first hole at Troon is. I make videos so that you can feel what it's like to go there. And I appreciate the opportunity, and all right, enough backslapping.
Before we go, though, we need to talk about the Tom Watson moment.
Oh, that was an incredible moment. We
need to talk about that. I'll set it up and then you can describe it.
okay.
So we obviously, we got an interview with Tom Watson for the film at Royal Portrush whilst you guys were over. And I think you maybe interviewed him for half an hour or so before we went outside to chat with him in the bowl at the 18th around the grandstands. And you and Tom were reminiscing about 1977 and the Jewel in the Sun and him and Jack. And it just led to it's absolutely the highlight of the film. It is. It's a really, everyone who's watched it has gone, that moment was incredible. And I remember you saying to me afterwards, like, wow. But anyway, I'll let you describe it better than I can.
You teed me up well there. This is an easy story to tell. So, well, first off, we do this 43 minute interview inside, which is a pretty long interview. And it's not a podcast, right? Like, a podcast is like casual, whatever. You don't really care. This is like, we're seated at the desk in the upstairs dining area of Royal Portrush. And we're, I'm nervous. And, I get nervous here and there. But Tom Watson, you're just like, I don't know. I just don't want to come off like an idiot. I don't want to make a mistake. I don't want to get a fact wrong.
Was Tom the biggest name golfer you'd interviewed at that point, or is that hard to say? But
I don't know if he was the biggest, but he was definitely different. Primarily because this was one of the first things we had shot for the film, for The Brief History of the Open. So that was one part of it. Also, technically, we were really, trying to push up our technical, so it's not just like a vlog. It's not just that we put a camera on the table and said talk. This was like multiple cameras, audio running, it's a whole thing. But also it was just like his level of stature within this world was very large. So, he's synonymous with the Open. It's like there's a lot there in my head. And it's also it's different to interview a young guy who's like, it's interviewed to different to interview Justin Thomas, because he's just like, you have the same vernacular, this is, I don't know what Tom Watson wants to talk about. I don't know, just whatever. And so we had this long interview, which was, whenever you step out of a long interview like that, it's a stage of decompression, because you're really, at least for me as an interviewer in a situation like that, you're on camera, so you have to look interested, and no matter what they're saying, even if you know what they're saying is like kind of veering off into like, we're never going to use that. And I only have so much time with this guy, so I got to like steer him into things that are compelling. And that didn't happen really, but but at the same time, you've got to think about what to ask next that dovetails into what they're saying now. And I do all my interviews with no notes. So I don't have like a piece of paper there. I'm not like writing down notes while they're talking. And so there's this like push pull of mental energy. Like, I'm listening, but I'm thinking. It's exhausting. Anyway, we break. I feel very excited. I feel very good. I slam a glass of water. We walk outside, and the idea is we're going to go just film us walking over to the 18th green. And, it's probably a 300-yard walk, so it takes like a couple minutes, maybe even less. But on the way, it takes us like 20 minutes to get there, because on the way, he's just like walking up these dunes and he's like, see, I could get up and down from here, you know? And he's like, that's what made me a force on the golf course. He's like, I could just get the ball up and down from anywhere, you know? And like, I was seeing images of him like in my head, like with the sweater, you know, and just like he's standing up on the dune with like holding no club, but he's just like, he's just hacking away into this. The gorse there, the heather, you know. And then so we walk under the like there's that tunnel that goes into the 18th at Portrush, kind of into the Gladiator grandstand, if you want to quote Adventures in Golf episode 1. You know, we go into this 18th area here with and we're standing there, and he just kind of stops, and we've got two cameras running and we've got audio going, and I'm just chuffed. You know what I mean? I'm just like, this is incredible. And he goes, let me tell you a story. And I was like, huh? Like, okay, let's go. Like, I'm ready. And, you know, it was, I mean, it made its way into the film in such a wonderful way, because he basically tells me the story of beating Jack Nicklaus in 77. And it's not about that, though. He tells a part of the story that I would imagine a lot of people who have even studied this tournament don't even know. He tells the story of golf in its form of a polite and it's not even polite is the word. It golf is a game that is you oh, I'm actually at a loss for words, but
he uses the term respect.
Respect
in the film. That's what the term Tom uses.
Yeah. I was thinking of golf as a game where you must consider your playing partner or your opponent, and consideration is like, in a sense, it's respect. Yes. There's an element of like brotherly respect. It's a friendly respect, even within some of the most fierce competitions that have taken place to date. There is an element of, and it's happened with other people too, like even Tiger has done the thing where he doesn't leave the green so that the other person can putt in peace, you know, because once Tiger leaves the green, hundreds of spectators go to the tee, so he just stands there and waits, and then, you know, there's more time. So he tells a story of respect where basically he's got Tom's basically got to make a 5-footer for par to win the Open, and Jack has just sunk a 30-footer to, obviously we're on the 18th green here, he calls it a jet engine roar, and we have footage that we spliced into this moment of Tom telling me the story, and then, you know, seeing the footage, and it's incredible. And basically, Tom is settling into his 5-footer, which is, I mean, got to be pretty terrifying, if I'm being totally honest. It's got to be totally terrifying. Tom's settling into this 5-footer to win the Open, and everyone's still cheering for Jack's 30-footer that just went down. Because if Tom misses the putt, then it goes a tie, and then, you know, playoff. Jack raises his hands and basically tells everyone to stop cheering. And Tom's account of it is the place went immediately silent. Tom putted, he made it. And then Tom goes on to tell me and reenact the second part of the story, which is Jack and Tom walking off the 18th green. Jack puts his arm around Tom's shoulder, and therefore Tom puts his arm around my shoulder, and he gets his head right into my ear, and he says, I gave you my best shot and it just wasn't good enough. And I mean, like, so I'm over here, like, I mean, I'm like cradled in Tom Watson's body, and he's reliving a moment in time that's sealed in all sorts of history books and archives. And I'm listening, I'm Tom Watson and he's Jack Nicklaus, and we're walking off the 18th at Portrush. I mean, that was, you know, thank you for reminding me of that, you know, because I see it on the screen and I'm looking at it from a filmmaker's perspective. I'm not similar to how you, when you walk to work up the 17th and 18th, you see it as just your walk to work rather than a place where champions and golf have been born. I see that scene in the film as just a scene in the film. There's a technical thing. I don't really like that. It's like, I wish I could have done it this way. You know, ever perfectioning things. But you're right. That moment as a human was incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I think you walk off arm in arm down the tunnel, and there's sort of a long shot of it, and then you sort of came back on your own and went, I think that was the highlight of my career, or something to that effect. And it is a special moment in the film, and it is a genuine goosebump moment. And the way that Tom Watson tells the story is just, it was like it was yesterday. You know, when you look at the, and I don't know how many times he's watched that footage back, but when you look at the footage and how he told the story and how you guys put it together, it's just like he could have been watching it and describing it. It's that succinct. It's crazy.
That was an incredible, incredible day. I remember that. I was just like, what just happened? Because it all was unplanned as well, which is a great part about the filmmaking that we do, is we plan a lot and then we don't plan a lot. And these unplanned moments just are so incredible to watch them unfold and be a part of and be documenting it so that we can share it with others. So please, go to theopen.com, sign up for the One Club, watch this film. I'm very proud of it. I can't wait. I'm proud. Will people be allowed to leave comments on the film when they watch it?
There isn't that functionality on the site, but we may put up some sort of email on the description. Otherwise, if people just want to leave you comments in the trailer, because I know we're going to be trailing it a little bit next week, then people can leave comments either on the Opens channels or your channels, and we can see what people think. But I'm sure everyone's gonna love it.
Everyone's gonna love it. You don't need to comment because I already know you loved it. I'm glad you enjoyed the video, folks. Thanks for watching it. Awesome. Well, thanks for your time, Paul, and thank you so much for the opportunity of a lifetime and for your diligence throughout. And everyone, please take a moment to check out this thing that we've been working very hard to make for you.
Thank you, Eric, and stay safe and stay well, and hope to catch up soon.
Very soon.